In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's Coolest Conversations podcast time in Little Steven's Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. My guest today is Jordan Albertson, the director of the documentary Boom, a film about the Sonics being one of, if not the, most influential 60s rock and roll band. Contemporary artists ranging from Jack White to Robert Plant continue to sing their praises. Jordan's film was shown on the film festival circuit a couple of years ago and now is in general theatrical release. To help set the stage, we'll hear a portion of the Sonics' 1964 debut single, The Witch. And afterwards, I'll be back with Jordan for your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
But you won't get far. She's gonna make you ill, 'cause she's the witch. Where she walks around late at night, won't stop people sleeping tight. If you hear a knocking on your door, you better sneak it away.
Mighty Manfred with you here in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and today for our coolest conversations, I'm joined by film director Jordan Albertson. He's responsible for putting together the documentary Boom, a film about the Sonics, which is playing in selected theaters. This is after having had a successful run on the film festival circuit several years ago. Hi, Jordan. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Man, I read that you were born in Seattle, I think raised on Whidbey Island in the Seattle area. What's Whidbey Island? Don't know anything about that.
Whidbey Island is an island about 45 miles north of Seattle. And it's there's a Navy base on the north end, and on the south end, it's just kind of farms and a little hippie town called Langley. It's a chill place. I actually just moved back about a few months ago. So I'm now back on Whidbey Island.
So it wasn't like Whidbey Island was some enclave off the end of the earth, right? I mean, or was it?
No. It's just kind of like a small town, like your typical small town. The only thing that really made it different was we're surrounded by water. So it was, you did have that extra step if you were going to sneak into the city. And really what that brewed is just, a little extra, rubble rousing, a little extra trouble that you find yourself getting into.
Well, we know the Sonics are important to you. How important was music in general as you were growing up?
Music was really important. I mean, movies and music, they've always kind of been my thing. Movies were what I wanted to do, and music was what I was like obsessed with.
Okay, so you're obsessed with music, but do you play any instruments?
Not well. I mean, I own like four guitars, but I can't play any of them. I'm a fan, that's what I love about music. With music, like, I've probably been to 300 concerts, I there's nothing better than being in the middle of a crowd and having that surge of power and energy that comes from being in a room with live music, and I've had that itch. But to be on stage and be a part of it, you know, that's never been it for me. I've always just been this huge fan. And that's really all I've ever wanted to be.
And so the film thing, so these were the two interests, but what got you into filmmaking?
Well, just being interested. I mean, when I was 4 or 5 years old, my mom showed me E.T. and I was like obsessed with it. I thought it was the most amazing thing ever. And once I got old enough and I could, you know, sort of read, I could see that it was, you know, directed by a person. And my mom had told me that, you know, that was the person who really kind of like made the movie. So, you know, forever, my future job description was to be like Steven Spielberg. And eventually I just said, well, obviously I'm not going to be Steven Spielberg, but I want to be a director, you know? And I never changed lanes. Like I never wanted to be a fireman or any of that. Like since I was 4 or 5, I always told everybody I was going to grow up and be a filmmaker. And I mean, that, you know, and so professionally or when I started making movies, I mean, you know, at a real young age, it was, you know, I'd be in school and they'd give us some sort of an assignment to do some sort of history project. And I would always talk the teacher into letting me do it as like a film or like a video project instead. And my family didn't have a lot of money. So we would always kind of like, I'd always borrow somebody else's video camera and we'd go into the woods and make a horror movie. And I'd turn it in as like my history project for something. It was completely unrelated. But that was kind of how I got going. I was always, you know, learning how to shoot, how to cut. I got really into photography when I was in high school. I had an amazing photography teacher, Mr. Wojcinski, who was really instrumental in having me, you know, think about things from that visual perspective. And he knew that I wanted to be a filmmaker, so he was always really gearing me towards photographers who maybe had more of a cinematic eye. And yeah, I mean, I've never strayed. And so right out of high school, I moved to LA. A good friend of my family, he's a sound mixer named Kirk Francis. He'd won an Oscar. And so he had, you know, mm-hmm. he was a pretty well-known sound recordist. And he had a job on a Harrison Ford movie. And he called me, I remember on a Friday, and he's like, hey, I got you a job on this Harrison Ford movie. And at the time I was still living on Whidbey Island working at this pizza place. And I was like, Kirk, I'm up in the Northwest. And he's like, yeah, well, get down here. And I remember I was like, well, I don't have a car. And he goes, buy one, and hung up the phone. And so I like called my dad and my mom. I was like, I got to move to LA. Kirk Francis got me a job on some movie. And they're like, you don't have a car. I'm like, I know. Can you help me? And like over the course of 2-3 days, I quit my job, bought a car. And my dad and I drove down to LA that Sunday. And the next day I was working with Harrison Ford on a movie as a PA. So that was my first job, you know, and it was a really great kind of crash course in the industry. I, you know, kind of learned from that and then quickly started up a little production company and started directing music videos and short films and raised financing for my first feature, which was this movie called The Standard that I wrote and directed.
And you had some success with The Standard too. Didn't it receive some positive reviews and did it show in any festivals?
Yeah. It premiered at SIFF, got some review, you know, won some awards, but it was at this weird time when, you know, independent movies were getting lost because the video market died. You know, once Netflix came out and it was kind of the death of Hollywood Video and Blockbuster. Right. And once those video stores crashed, like there wasn't really a way to make money. So The Standard just got kind of lost in that whole crazy thing. And so the movie really never got released. And, you know, when your movie doesn't get released, you don't really have anything to show people to kind of like piggyback you into whatever the next job was. So all of a sudden, I didn't really have anything to show for anything. And it was hard. It was a real hard time. And that was right about when Boom kind of came into my life.
All right. Well, that's before we describe that. It's important here. You're talking about your folks and they seem to be really supportive. And then your father also ties into this whole, you know, your love of the Sonics. So you were around 12 or 13 and he introduces you to the band. And how does that take place? What's the form of that?
Well, just to go back a little bit, like my dad, like when I was growing up, my parents separated when I was probably 7 or 8. But my dad was always around. Like my mom and dad were always, they still were good friends, even though the marriage had fallen apart. And, but my dad and I never connected. Like we weren't really close. I just didn't relate to him. I was kind of into punk rock music and rock and roll and trying to figure out how to watch a Clockwork Orange. Like I wanted to watch, I was really interested in, you know, darker, fringier kind of things. And my father was like super, just, I thought really boring. You know, he had one tape in his truck and it was, you know, Dire Straits. And I remember just like, to me as a 12, 13 year old boy who'd like just discovered, you know, the Ramones, and like there was nothing worse than Dire Straits. It was like the cleanest, most boring ass music I'd ever heard in my life. And my dad just never talked about any other music. And so I assumed that my dad just had horrible taste. And there was this one day my dad, he walked by me, and I tell this story in the film, but my, you know, he walked by my bedroom and he heard me listening to Nirvana, because this is in, you know, the 90s as a kid in the Northwest. So I was obsessed with Pearl Jam and Alice in Chains and Soundgarden and of course Nirvana. And he walked by and he kind of stopped in the doorway. And I remember, and I had it up really loud, so I assumed he was just going to tell me to turn it down, because that's usually what my conversations consisted of. My dad and I had turned my music off. And he stopped in the doorway and he kind of just stood there for a minute. And he said, he's like, man, if you like this, you should hear the Sonics. And I just stopped and I looked at him and I was like, what? And I thought he was talking about the basketball team. I honestly didn't know what he was talking about. And then he just kind of walked away. And I was like, what the fuck was that? Like, it was just the weirdest thing.
Yeah.
And a few days later, I get home from school and there's this album resting against my door. And I pick it up and it's the Sonics, Boom. And I'm like, what? Like, what is this? And I went into my room and I put it on and was just like, before the first song even starts, and the first song is Cinderella. And I remember the way it, like the tone of the guitar warming up, and I just like the hair on the back of my neck stood up, and I was like, what is this? And then that song starts and it's just like this cool, dark, edgy, badass proto punk thing. And I'm like, what the fuck? And so I, you know, look at the back of the record and it's like, you know, 1966. And I'm like, what? There's no way. You know, like when you get into punk rock music and you learn about, you know, the history of it, it's like, you know, you got the stuff in 77 and you got the stuff of the UK, and then you got the New York scene, which brings you to like the New York Dolls, you keep going back further. And then you get into Bowie and Lou Reed and then, you know, the Velvet Underground and MC5. And it's like the Stooges. And like, as far as you go, really going back is like, what, 68. And all of a sudden my dad is like dropping this like punk rock knowledge bomb from like 1966 in my lap. And I'm like, what is this? Like, what, how did Mr. you know, straight lace, never done drugs in his life, listening to, you know, chicks for
Dire Straits,
right? Like, what is this? Like, no way. So I went and I asked my dad.
We know, Jordan, there's also this aspect of, and you're a kid or a teenager, no one wants to really think the parents ever had sex, right? It's like gross. I mean, like, you don't really realize that, you know, all the experiences that you were feeling, you know, your, especially if your adolescent years, that your parents, they can't relate to you. You know, they can't. They're so uncool. But they, you know, they are, in fact, you know, they have gone through this whole process. So it's like, here he is delivering this thing, as you said, this bomb. It's like, that is just beyond mind-boggling. And you were mentioning, too, about how the things you were interested in are edgier and stuff. And here, the needle is going across songs like He's Waiting, you know, Satan Knows What You Did. You know, it's like, that's got to be like completely short-circuiting your brain.
It did. It completely short-circuited my brain. So I immediately went out and I like was like, Dad, what is this? You know, and he's just like, oh yeah, these are these guys I used to go see when I was in college, and they'd play like bowling alleys and shit. And I was like, you saw these guys in bowling? Like, so I just all of a sudden started talking to my dad about music, you know, and yeah, so we talked about the Sonics, and he's like, yeah, they're this little Tacoma band. And so all of a sudden I'm like, well, what else were you doing? Like, I want to know more about your life, because I'd never really asked him, you know. And my dad had this really kind of interesting history where he basically stopped listening to music like right around 1970. He really, like, I introduced my dad to AC/DC, and I introduced my dad to even like Led Zeppelin and Sabbath and things like that, because he just kind of stopped. He started, you know, having family and started a job and kind of gave up all that. But before that, you know, so I asked my dad, I was like, well, did you ever go to any concerts? And he's like, I only went to like 4 or 5. And I was like, well, who'd you go see? And he's like, well, I saw Jimi Hendrix, saw the Beatles, I saw Janis Joplin, I saw the Beach Boys when they were touring behind Pet Sounds. And so he's telling me this, and I'm just like, what? Like, you know, my nerdy dad, who's like all of a sudden dropping this punk rock knowledge bomb, also happened to go see like some of the most insane concerts that ever probably happened in Seattle. And so it just opened up this door for my father and I. We just connected all of a sudden. And it was this powerful connection with music. And then obviously I found out my dad was this huge cinephile. And so then we connected on that way. And you know, so those were like those two things. And it became this constant conversation between him and I. And the Sonics, you know, even growing up and had other friends that were interested in punk rock music and read all the books on punk rock music and everything, like, you just never heard about the Sonics. So I felt like, you know, we had kind of like this inside secret thing, you know, and it was amazing. It was really, really cool.
You know, here's something too, that's your dad, I guess about 70, you said he just sort of stopped listening to music. And one thing that I think is great about the Sonics is, well, they stopped playing. Not that it was great that they stopped playing, but when they stopped and then they come back again, you know, there wasn't this, a lot of groups that stayed together, you know, they felt a compelling to grow as artists, which doesn't mean that you don't ever want to grow as artists, but had they gone on to something else, you know, it wouldn't have been the same. And when they got back together, it was that same vitality, that same power, that same, you know, it was just like picking up where they left off. I saw the band a couple of times of this. They played this tattoo convention, and was it
Ink and Iron?
Out in Long Beach. The Ink and Iron. And they, I'm playing a band called The Woggles, and we had played with them both those times. So the first time, this was when, you know, Jerry was still singing lead, Jerry Rosalie still singing lead in the band. And I can't remember who they had on bass, but Freddie, you know, was not on bass at the time, it was somebody else. I don't think it was, said Larry Andy. I don't think it was Andy Paripa, but maybe it was. In any event, went out into the audience. You know, I'm standing back, and the sound is great, and it's just as powerful. Just everything you would hope for, and that's sort of the power that you hear off those early records. And I overhear these two guys in front of me, and one guy saying to the other guy, he said, "These guys look like a dad band." Ryan says, "You look like a dad band." And then the other guy, without missing a beat, goes, "Yeah, like if your dad was fucking cool." And I just thought, yeah.
That's funny.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know? So there's, I think that's, it's this weird thing. Yeah. So you're, and I'm really happy to hear about the, one of my questions here was, what's your relationship like before he introduced the Sonics to you, what it's been like since? Did he ever get a chance to meet? Did you ever introduce him to the guys in the band?
Yeah. Yeah. So that show at the Moore Theater that's in the film, my dad was at that show, and he got to go backstage, and he met, you know, Chris Novoselic from Nirvana. He got to, you know, meet the guys in the band, and they were really sweet, you know, cause they knew, they hadn't seen the film yet, but they kind of knew that I had devoted so much of my life to doing it. And they heard the story that he introduced me. So a couple of them were like really thankful. And then he got to meet him again when the film had its US premiere at the Tacoma Film Festival. At that point, I think the guys in the band were really emotional and moved by the film once they saw what it, you know, what the film was. And yeah, that was really special. And I don't know if you know this, but my father actually passed away a couple of years ago.
And no, I did not know that. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And he, I'm just so glad that he never got to see the film and it's like finished for him. And obviously he never knew that it got released and that it's finally having, you know, having its moment. But I'm really thankful that he got to see it and, you know, be a part of all that. Cause it really was, it was just so cool to get him backstage and, you know, see that side of it.
So your dad gets you into the Sonics, but obviously the band continues to resonate with you. So your decision to do the film was seeing them at this reunion show. And it wasn't the Cave Stomp reunion thing in New York City. It's when they came and played there in Seattle.
Yeah. I had missed the whole Cave Stomp thing. I was in LA kind of grinding away and I had heard, it was an article I read in Rolling Stone magazine where it had talked about the Sonics were playing around Europe and like selling out these big arenas. And I was like, what is this? And then shortly after that, they announced this, their first hometown show, which was Halloween night at the Paramount Theater. Little Steven actually came out at that show, which was, you know, incredible. But yeah, so I flew up from LA and my dad and I went, and my sister and my brother, we made it like a big family event. And we all went to go see the Sonics at the Paramount Theater. And it was just so unreal, you know, like being a music fan, you know, you're always talking about like what your dream reunions are going to be like, oh my God, is Led Zeppelin going to play together again or whatever. Right. And I had never even thought about the Sonics reuniting because they were such a like mysterious group, you know, that it wasn't even like in the conversation because it was just so out of the realm of possibility. I never thought that it could truly happen. So just standing there and seeing these guys rock out, and the show was so great. I remember about halfway through the show, I just said to myself, I was like, I'm going to make a movie about the Sonics. And that night I went back to my dad's house and I stayed up all night and I went on the internet and I was just trying to find some sort of a contact for the band. And I found this email address that was like management@sonics.com. And so I stayed up all night and wrote this huge treatment for this crazy cinematic movie I wanted to make, one that I never did make, but one that I wanted to make. And, I got a reply the next morning from Buck Ormsby, because when they had gotten, you know, offers to reunite, I think the band called up Buck because they just didn't know who else to contact, because he, you know, back in the 60s, he was the guy that kind of did all that for him. So they called him up again.
And, right. And here, let's put some context to Buck, because he was the bass player in the Wailers, or Fabulous Wailers, very popular band in the Pacific Northwest, and they were popular enough to have their own record label, Etiquette Records, and those first two Sonics albums were on Etiquette. They, in a sense, you know, signed the Sonics to their label, and he acted too as a kind of a business manager for them in that era.
Yep. So Buck kind of discovered the Sonics, and he signed them to Etiquette, and he technically was the producer of, you know, Here Are the Sonics and Boom, So Buck wrote me back, and I was sort of caught off guard because I obviously knew who Buck Ormsby was. I'm a big fan of the Fabulous Wailers, and he invited me to go down to Tacoma and have coffee with him. And so the next day I went to Tacoma and I sat with Buck and I just pitched him the movie. I want to make a movie. I want to make a documentary. I want to tell the story. I want to, you know, do this big cinematic retelling of the band's history. And at the time, I didn't even know what the history was. I didn't even care. I was just like, I'm going to make a fucking movie about it because this is amazing and this music. And, you know, Buck loved my energy. And I think him and I had a really similar kind of like never give up on anything kind of energy. And so we became really good friends. And I could tell we kind of bonded over that coffee, and we shook hands, and he was like, all right, man, let's do this.
So Jordan, I want to interrupt in a second, cause I'm scared I'll forget to go back to this, but I really am curious as to, you know, when you wrote this sort of detailed email and this, and it's sort of this extravagant version of the film, what would that have been? If you had had all the finances at your fingertips, what would this, how would it differ from what you did?
Hugely. I mean, what the movie I originally envisioned, and honestly, I'm glad I didn't make that movie, because I was like, 24 when I thought of this, and I thought it would be like a great idea. And I assumed that, you know, I could just interview the original members of the band, and that I could, you know, go and film like their story. So it was going to be a documentary, but we'd never see the Talking Heads, and it was going to be just this. I wanted to, like, you know, spend $500,000-$600,000 like recreating the, you know, like hire people, like cast people, and have, you know, thousands of extras, and like go and create, you know, really cinematic, beautiful footage of those shows and that stuff. And I, so that was the idea, you know, and a very expensive idea. And a lot of documentaries at that time weren't really doing stuff like that. Now it's kind of become the norm. You see any doc on Netflix and it's all about, you know, these really high production value, you know, kind of filming of whatever people are talking about. But I thought that there would be, so I wanted to make more of like a punk rock kind of fun coming of age story. You know, I thought that that's what the story was really going to be. So, you know, like I said, Buck and I thought that was awesome. And I took off to Hollywood, and I was very naive. I mean, I had just signed to a pretty big agency, and I had assumed that I would just kind of like roll in there and say like, hey, cool, I got this thing. Let's go get some money, right? Isn't that what you guys do? Like, how do we do this? And my agent, I sat down with him, and he was like, Jordan, I mean, this is like a small band. I mean, how do you expect us to get money on this? And I was like, well, I don't know. Isn't that, what the fuck? What do you do? Like, how does this work? And he's like, man, you got to go get like a Justin Bieber doc going if you think you're going to get $1 million. And it was like the reality of it came kind of crashing down. And I was like, oh, this is going to be a lot more difficult than I thought. So I spent about 5 years trying to raise financing, trying to put money together, you know, shaking all the trees I could. And it was just depressing. I mean, nobody was really interested. People thought it was kind of a cool idea, but it just, the idea of putting together a big chunk of money, I just wasn't able to do it. And it's right around that time Indiegogo and Kickstarter were kind of getting started. And so I was like, this will be the thing. I could easily get 500 grand from this. And I spent about a year putting together this really big Kickstarter campaign, or Indiegogo is what we did. And that launched and just bombed like hard. We made around $11,000, and half of that, I think, came from my father. And at that point it was like, well, there's no movie, you know, I mean, there's no way this can happen. But Buck and I would always get on the phone and kind of pump each other up. Like, hey man, we're still going to do this. And it was around this time, Buck and I had a conversation, and I could tell he didn't sound good over the phone, but he wasn't real forthcoming with me about his health. But I remember saying to him, I was like, hey Buck, maybe I should come up to Seattle and film your interview. And there was this long pause, and he just said back to me, I think that's a good idea. So I knew what that meant, and he did too, but it was this unsaid thing between us. So I went up to Seattle, and I spent 2 days filming this interview with Buck. And at that point we had no other footage, but I just knew I needed to get this interview with Buck in the can. And when I did that, there was this whole other story that was presented to me that Buck had done. And I realized that the movie that I had been wanting to make was completely dead. But I was so determined just to make a movie about the Sonics. That's why I call this movie Boom, a film about the Sonics. Because for years, I just kept telling everybody that I was making a film about the Sonics, but I wasn't doing it. I just was trying to, you know? But the story that Buck had told me was so emotional and so interesting and gave me this whole other perspective of what had happened, especially during the 70s and 80s, without kind of blowing the movie for people who haven't seen it. But it kind of opened my mind and I said, okay, I need to be open to what movie I can make, you know, if I make this thing. So I got that interview in the can. And then shortly after that, my whole life kind of fell apart in LA. I had a couple other movies that were close to being financed and everything fell apart. And I was just completely broke. I couldn't get a job at a grocery store. I was totally depressed. If I'm being honest, suicidal. And my girlfriend at the time, Sasha, her parents had this house out in Montana that needed to be worked on. And it was just kind of like this old house that we could live in for free. And I remember telling her, I was like, tomorrow, we're leaving tomorrow. And we did. We packed up my dog Monster, my girlfriend Sasha and I. We literally just threw everything in a U-Haul and drove out to Bozeman, Montana. And honestly, like, I thought that that was the end. Like, I thought that that was me giving up on movies. And it was right around that time Buck actually passed away. And you know, him and I were so close. That was this huge, heartbreaking thing for me to deal with just personally. And then the other part of it was that Buck was my connection to the band and Buck was my connection to other rock stars, you know, because I knew that I was going to have to try to rally up big rock stars to be in this thing. And you know, when Buck passed, it was just like all of that was done. And all of a sudden I'm out in Montana. I get this job at a sushi restaurant. I'm just like, it was the lowest point in my life. So I worked.
And let's remark again on that you're in Bozeman and you're working at a sushi restaurant.
yeah, I know.
Because, you know, that's incongruous, right? What? You know?
Yeah, I know, man. I thought,
but sushi, as it turns out, has been very good to you.
Well, it turned out to be very good to me. I took this job and they made me the host at the restaurant because I was this grumpy asshole. And, you know, it was an extremely busy restaurant and I was just pretty hard nosed up there. I could handle a 2-hour wait with a bunch of drunk college kids and just not care and just handle it. And 6 months go by and I never talked about my history in film with the staff, like friends I'd made out there. It was like, I just kind of was embarrassed and humiliated. And I felt like I'd let Buck down and I was just really depressed and drinking a lot. But there was this one day where I'm hosting and it was an extremely busy day, night. We were on a 2-hour wait and I get this phone call and it's this woman, Ashley. And she said, God, we just got done driving for 12 hours. I need a table for 12. Is there any way we could come in there? We're going to be there in like 5 minutes. And I remember just putting the phone down and I was like, oh my God, there's no way. And I look into the parking lot and it's just packed with people. We're on this 2-hour wait. A table of 12 would have probably been 3 hours. And it's the one time I ever did this. I kind of looked out into the parking lot at these like drunk college kids who'd been driving me insane all night. And I was just thinking about this mom with this huge family, drove for 12 hours. And I was like, you know what? Fuck these college kids. I'm going to get this mom in this restaurant. I'm taking care of her. So I get back on the phone and I was like, Ashley? She goes, yeah. And I was like, ask for Jordan when you get here. I'm going to get you in. She goes, oh my God, no way. And I was like, I got you. So a few minutes later, she comes walking in. She's got these two kids hanging off her arms. And I was like, Ashley? She goes, yeah, are you Jordan? And I was like, yeah. And she goes, oh my God, you have no idea. You're a lifesaver. I'm like, don't worry about it. I'm taking care of you. It's like, just go wait in the parking lot. I'll come find you in a couple minutes. I'm just getting that table ready. So I get the table ready and I go and I walk out into the parking lot and I see Ashley in this group of 12 and she's standing next to her husband and he's got his back to me. And I instantly recognize this guy because being a
kid. Wait, he's got his back to you.
Yeah. And I recognized
you recognize his backside?
Yes, I could just recognize him from his head. I knew him because I'm such a music fan, and being a kid from the Northwest, I had Pearl Jam posters all over my wall. And sure enough, this guy turns around and it's Mike McCready. And I look at him and he looks at me and I said, "Holy shit, you're Mike McCready." And then he goes, "Yeah." And I remember thinking to myself, "Oh my God, you said that out loud, you idiot. I didn't mean to say that out loud." And he just goes, "Yeah, man. Hey, nice to meet you, Bob." And he's being really sweet. And all of a sudden I kind of stopped and I paused. And then I just like, "Oh my God, Mike, I've been trying to get in touch with you for 10 years. I'm making a movie about the Sonics and blah, 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 blah." And I just vomited this pitch at him. I just like assaulted Mike McCready with this pitch about my Sonics movie that was completely dead at that point. And Mike just stood there and he kind of heard me and he could tell that I was just like completely losing my mind. And he said, "Hey man, I'm in." And I was like, "What?" And he goes, "Dude, I'm in." And I was like, and then I just, "Well, let me take you to your table." And so I started shaking and I'm sweating from my armpits. I'm like, "Well, now what do I do? I still don't have any money." All of a sudden I just told the guitarist from Pearl Jam, "I'm making this movie that I'm not making." I mean, it's completely dead. But so I sit Mike down and, you know, him and Ashley were so sweet and they were so cool. And Mike kept pulling me over to the table and he's like, "Well, tell me more, tell me more." And I just kind of told him about everything I'd been going through. And he was like, "Dude," he pulls out his cell phone. I'll never forget this. Pulls out his cell phone and he goes, "Who else do you need?" And in that moment, he texted Nancy Wilson, texted Kim Thayil. He texted all these people and validated everything that I'd spent the last 10 years trying to do, and just and basically greenlit the movie for me right there. And at that point it was like, well, I didn't have any money to make the movie, but I didn't care. You know, when you've got, you know, Mike McCready, people all of a sudden respond to your emails and phone calls. And so I called up Chris Kozer, who's my DP, and I was like, "Hey man, we're back on." And he's like, "Oh, did you get financing?" I was like, No, I didn't. I'm going to need you to steal camera equipment for all of these interviews, but we're going. And that was how we did it. So it was really that encounter with Mike that saved the movie, probably saved my life. I mean, I was at the lowest point in my life and it was incredible. It just, I'm forever in debt to Mike and Ashley.
So I want to ask about some of these people that he pulled up and you get involved in the film, but first, so Buck was the touchstone. I mean, he's the one that you obviously had this really great relationship with. But with the band members themselves, so once Buck is on board, were those guys completely, were they all on board immediately because Buck said so? Or were there people in the band that were like, "I don't know if this is a good idea. I don't really want to do this." And did you have to win those guys over independently of what Buck was encouraging them to do?
Buck and I were really careful when we first agreed to do this. We were really careful to not really tell the band because I didn't want to come off as a flake. So I didn't want to let them know really what I was doing until it was a fully financed, you know, engine that was about to take off. I didn't want to I know how the film industry is. So many people are always talking about doing shit and then nothing ever happens. And I really did not want to come off that way to the band members. So I was pretty protective about when to contact them, you know, but I was in.
Okay. So that's all right. So this is important here. So you start and then it's dead and then McCready comes in and it's on. So at what point did you reveal, "Hey, This is really going to happen now. I'm really making it"?
It was right around then. I had reached back out to all the members and they had met me kind of in the peripheral because I had shown up to kind of random shows to get B-roll and to shoot them. And so they had known a little bit, but I hadn't really come at them with like, "Oh my God, I'm doing this thing." They knew that there was this guy that was devoting a large period of his life to doing this thing. And the fact that I kept showing up, I think they kind of, you know, over 8-9 years realized that I wasn't a flake and that I wasn't a faker, you know, that I was really trying to do this. And so by the time, you know, Buck had passed away and then McCready's involvement became a thing and I was trying to shoot it, you know, they were like, okay, hey, we can make this work. And there were a couple kind of stars that aligned. You know, Bob Bennett comes to
drummer.
Yeah, the original drummer. He comes to the Northwest usually once a year just to kind of visit family and friends. And it happened to be when I was going to be coming out to Seattle to try to get an interview with Jerry and Larry. And
again, we should say, you know, Jerry's lead singer.
Yep.
Larry was the lead guitar player.
Exactly. Yeah. And
I'd say Jerry's the lead singer, but also the keyboard player. Or
yep. Yep. And they all told me that, you know, oh, Andy, who's the bass player and Larry's brother, Andy doesn't want to be involved. He won't. There's no way Andy will be a part of any of this. That's what everybody kept saying. Even Bucket told me that. Oh, Andy, he won't want to do it. He won't want to do it. And I was like, fuck, you know. But I got Larry and I got Bob to agree to shoot at Larry's house. And so I drove to Larry's house. And when I pulled up, Andy Parepa is standing on the deck. And I just kind of went with it. And I think what had happened is I think Larry just kind of told Andy that I was coming to do this. And Andy decided to show up. And honestly, Andy ended up being the first guy that I interviewed. And his memory was so sharp. It got Bob and Larry to kind of, you know, jump into it too. And I think there was Andy and Larry. I don't think we're talking a lot then. And I kind of got the impression that day sort of brought them all back together because they ended up all going to get lunch afterwards. It was this really beautiful thing that kind of happened. And, but yeah, that's how I got the three of them. And then Jerry, I connected with and shot downtown Seattle. My friend Brian Kasniak drove Jerry out. And then Rob Lind, my DP and the producer of the film, Brian Robinson, they kind of caught Rob when he was down in LA and I sent the questions. And so that was how we...
Right. And again, so let's make clear that Rob is the sax player.
Yep.
And then, yeah.
Yeah. So it was, I just had to kind of piece it and chunk it together in that way. And so once I had those interviews, I still didn't have a film, you know, and I knew that the film that I had in my mind was dead, but I all of a sudden was just making a movie, you know. I didn't know how the hell it was going to go. And I definitely wasn't a professional editor and had never edited a feature. But I all of a sudden was like, well, I guess I got to do that too. And it was just this, I kind of pieced it together and started chunking this story together. So once I had those interviews, I had gone through a bunch of the footage that I had and I had this, I was combing. I was at that point, I was all of a sudden really overwhelmed. Like, okay, well now I don't have I got to figure out like an arc to a film. And
right.
I never wanted to be the narrator. I never thought I'd be the narrator. I figured we'd reach out to Henry Rollins or something, you know, or Dave Grohl or some guy that narrates all these documentaries. But I started to go into this basement of my house and I would start to record some narration just to fill in these gaps so I could start to chunk together an edit of the movie. And there were two big pieces that made that become a thing, me being the narrator. One of my best friends, a guy named Mike Evans, he's a really, he's an amazing writer and a producer. One night him and I were staying up listening to records all night and he asked me, he was like, why are you spending so much time of your life trying to make this movie about this band? It's like, what are you doing this for? And I never even considered that. I'd like, God, I don't know. I'd never thought about it. And he asked me, he goes, well, how did you get introduced to the band? And I told him the story about my father. And I looked over at him and he had like tears running down his face after I told him that story. And he looked at me and he goes, you got to put that in the movie. And I remember thinking, no way. Like, that sounds like the most self-important, pretentious, like, no, I'm not putting myself in the movie. And so that was always in the back of my mind as I started to kind of cut it. Cause that was actually one of the last pieces that I put in there. And then there was a really early kind of rough assembly of just the band telling their story with these chunks of narration that I'd put in. And I needed someone to see it because I was basically making it completely alone, and I needed some eyes. And I can only show my wife so many chunks of scene.
Yeah.
She's just like, it's fine. I don't know. I can't see this shit anymore. And
right, right.
I had when I was in high school, I'd become friendly with a guy named Scott Mosier. Scott produced Clerks, Mallrats, and Chasing Amy, and Dogma with Kevin Smith. And so Scott was this like legend in the independent film scene. And I was really lucky to meet Scott at an early age. And Scott was always really sweet. And he would, you know, anytime I'd write an email, he would always respond, you know. And so he was this like, this person that I really looked up to that I tried to not reach out to too often. But at this point, I just needed somebody who could put eyes on it. And I reached out to Scott, and he was actually in Paris because he was directing this Grinch cartoon for DreamWorks. And so he was super busy, but I was like, hey man, I got this weird rock doc. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. Like, can you just take a look at this? And he was like, okay. And I sent it to him, and he called me back, and he was like, man, he really liked it. And the one thing he said, he's like, you know, your narration, I think, is going to be the key to tying this all together. And that's when I went, oh no. Really? And he's like, yeah, man, I think so. Because the last thing I wanted to do is become like a character in the movie. But I thought, you know, okay, I'll give that a shot. I'll kind of lean into that a little bit. And once I did, that was when the film really started to take like a shape. And there were a lot,
right,
like, you know, Buck was in a way almost like this father figure to the band. And obviously my story with my father, and then there's the guy in the record store, Danny Dawkins, with his father. So I started to kind of think about these ideas and themes. And anyway, so that was really how I started to find a film in the footage.
So a couple of things here before we go on. One was when you mentioned, so Andy's never going to do it. And then of course he happens to be there, and he's going to contribute. And I'm not surprised by that, because there was a, not sure if this magazine still exists, but, you know, familiar with Gold Mine, which is, you know, like a record collector newspaper magazine. I was thinking it was like a monthly thing. I'm not sure if it's still, if Gold Mine's still around, but there was another, it's like a gold, I had a competitor, it was called maybe Disc, but they had, Andy Parepa did a Sonics, really extensive Sonics interview for that. And I just think when the man with the camera shows up, and the guy in the band knows that the other people are going to be telling a story, he's going to want his version there, you know. And I remember reading that article, and it was really pretty detailed. So I'm not surprised that you know, he had, you know, you reported that, or you said that, you know, he had really good memory for a lot of the events that had taken place when the band was, you know, in its heyday. Before we go on, a couple of other things here. What these, when you get these other people involved, you know, Mark is calls up, you know, there's Nancy Wilson from Heart, or texts them, and the Kim Thayil from Soundgarden, Mudhoney's Mark Arm. Those guys, do you think when they say, oh, we love the band, we're influenced by the band, how did the band influence any of those artists, do you think? Do you think, you know, is it an influence, or, you know, they're just excited about the band, just a cool thing? What is it exactly?
I think individually, for every one of those people, it's a whole different story. You know, Nancy Wilson was really, really interesting, because she, you know, Heart, her and her sister, her and Anne, were from Bellevue. And one of the things that I didn't put in the film, but Nancy Wilson's first concert was seeing the Sonics at a bowling alley in Bellevue when she was, you know, a teenager. And she, her explaining that concert was like, you know, this, you could just tell it was this really special event in her life. Like seeing those guys just playing balls to the wall, just rocking the shit out of that place, clearly was a massive influence on her. And, you know, and the fact that the band never took off, but, you know, when they broke up and her and Anne had those, you know, 45s, you know, of like Psycho and the Witch, and they would listen to them all the time. So I don't know if that music was, you know, really influential on the music of Heart, but I do know that the Sonics as a band were a big deal for Nancy, you know? And then, you know, Mike McCready, you know, the way he talked about them is they were such a part of that like underground party scene in Seattle. So you would hear that music. So I think Peripheral, like that music was always sort of a part of the heartbeat of what became, you know, the Northwest, or, you know, grunge explosion that you know, whatever you guys want to call it, kind of a, the thing that happened in the 80s with all those guys and Green River and Mudhoney. And, you know, Mark Arm talks about specifically how, you know, Jerry Rosley was like his biggest inspiration as a singer, you know, he was like trying to sing like him. So, yeah, I mean, you know, the Sonics, were like directly and indirectly a huge influence for all those guys.
Well, what is your favorite Sonic song? Do you have one?
God, somebody just asked me this. It changes like all the time. Cause
all right. Well, what's the top of the pops right now, Sonics wise?
I mean, He's Waiting is so cool and so badass, but The Witch is just such a banger. It's somewhere, but even Cinderella. See, I can't do it. I can't pick one. They're all so badass.
Well, they're all special in their own way. Well, I think, you know, so The Witch, that was before, I guess, Sub Pop with Nirvana, but The Witch was like the biggest, supposed to be, as I've read, the biggest independent selling single in the history of the Pacific Northwest. You know, so that was a big deal. And actually, it did get like airplay, like in Pittsburgh. I think maybe even the band went there, and also someplace in the Midwest that they actually traveled to, maybe did a show or promotional thing. Remember that article whatever, not the Gold Mine, but the other version of Gold Mine. Andy Parepa talks about they got, you know, there was, he said, they didn't realize how stupid they were being, but like a radio station in San Francisco was like, hey, we're playing your record. We want you to come down and do a show, we'll promote it. And they said, well, how much are you going to pay us? And the guy said, I'm not paying you anything. And they said, we don't do shows for free. And, you know, hung up on the guy, not realizing that, you know, they would have to do those things to sort of break the record out of the Northwest, you know?
they didn't know what they were doing. You know, I mean, and I don't think Buck totally knew what he was doing either outside of the Northwest. I mean, they were just kind of selling records out of the back of their cars, you know, like it was, I think the idea of becoming some big, huge band, it really wasn't something any of them thought about. You know, they were just teenage boys really just trying to get laid, you know, I think was kind of it. They just wanted to party and have fun. And none of them thought that they were talented. You know, one of the first things when I met Larry, you know, and I asked him, I was like, God, how did you get that tone? And, you know, I was kind of nerding out on, and Larry was like, honestly, Jordan, I just didn't know how to play the guitar. Like, I just played it really hard because I wanted to be heard over Bob's insane drumming. And it was just like, it's kind of like this magic thing. And I don't think any of them realized how special it was.
Right. And if they had, you know, again, if so, it was, you know, the way it has all come together is the best. You know, fortunately, Larry didn't keep playing to get to a point where sort of the magic of it was secondary to a musicianship, you know, that may not have resonated as widely. You know, that's what I'm getting at. Okay, so the film. You finally finish the film. McCready helps you get these contacts, and you kind of do this guerrilla thing, and you finish it, and then you get it out on this festival circuit, but that's still, you know, that's like 2018. You're getting it shown at festivals. And I know we had the pandemic that probably throws a wrench in the thing, but why is the film now being shown in theaters? What was the lag here? Is it just the pandemic?
No, that's kind of another story. So when the film started playing in festivals, I knew that I wasn't really finished with the film. I knew that there was still a lot of archival stuff that I was trying to get my hands on. But I had honestly expressed all of the energy I had, and I finally kind of got it to a point that was, you know, good enough to kind of tour the festival circuit. So what I did is I tried to take that as like a test screening process, because I knew I wanted to cut about 10 minutes of the movie out, and I wanted to get more photos and more music and another interview, actually, I wanted to get. So I toured around with the movie for about a year, and the last festival it played at, I was kind of going to hunker down and work on the edit. And about a week later, my brother passed away. And then the day of his funeral, my wife found out she was pregnant with our first kid. And then 3 months later, COVID happened. So I was kind of just hit, like boom, 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 boom. And once COVID happened, and I had this pregnant wife in the middle of this pandemic, I mean, I couldn't sit and work on this movie. Like, we were in survival mode. And so I had to put a pin in things for about a year. And so it was about 2021. It was about a year later. We had our first son, and I was like, okay, I need to pull these hard drives out and get this movie out and work on some of these things to try to get some of these other photos. And it was right around that time I got a phone call from Larry Paripa, the guitar player of the Sonics. And he said, Jordan, I'm cleaning out my garage, and I with COVID and everything, he's like, I've had some time on my hands. And I found these two boxes that say Sonics on it. And I was like, well, what's in the boxes, Larry? And he was like, I don't know, but they're yours if you want them. And I was like, well, yeah, but I kind of like, do I need to come out from Montana and check these boxes out? He's like, I don't know. It just kind of hung up on me. I was like, oh, shit. Okay. And then, so I called up Chris Kozer, my DP, and I was like, hey, I wanted to get some more footage. I just got some more music. Larry's got these two boxes. Let's fire this thing back up. So I drove out to Seattle, and I go to Larry's house, and he points out to his garage, and he's got these two boxes. And I open up the first box, and at the top of the first box is this, it's literally everything I had been looking for. It was this family photo album that the Paripas' parents had kept during the band's run, you know, because to them it was like this cute thing that their boys were doing. So like every newspaper clipping, all these photos that no one had ever seen, like personal stuff, it was awesome. So it was literally all the archival stuff that I had been missing. So I was excited. I was like, okay, great. I, you know, had this stuff, and I spent a couple months tightening up the film, adding in this archival stuff, and I finished the edit. And then about a week later, I found out my father was sick. So I had to stop everything again. I found out my father had brain cancer. And so I came back out to the Northwest. My wife with our new baby was staying with my mom, and my sister and I moved my dad into my sister's house, and we care for my father collectively for about 6-7 months until he passed away. And so that, you know, everything stopped again. And I also was just a kind of a mess, and it took me a while to get my shit together and put my big boy pants on and start working on the movie stuff again. And so that took another year out of all of that. And then you know, things kind of picked up again in 2022. And that was when I got in touch with Mark from The Forge, who ended up being the company that was going to distribute the film. Cause I had a couple offers from other people. And so, you know, Mark got involved and he was really enthusiastic and, you know, willing to give the film like a theatrical release and, you know, make it a really fun release. And he was, you know, willing to do all that work. And most distribution companies these days are, you know, they don't want to do anything. So it was exciting and it was a cool partnership. And so that took a couple of years to kind of fine tune all that. But yeah, basically, you know, why it took so long from 2018 to now is I just kind of got hit with a lot of life stuff.
Yeah. Well, let's see, today is the 25th, Friday the 25th. I know it was scheduled to be shown last night in Toronto. Has it played in many countries outside of the U.S.?
So the film hasn't opened outside of the U.S. except for Canada yet. But we are currently working on an international release, which is exciting. But yeah, we haven't announced it yet, but it will be playing in theaters, you know, all around Europe. And after that, the film will be available digitally. It's going to stream and we're going to do a Blu-ray release. And we're also talking about, based on the, you know, how interested people are, you know, maybe even doing a vinyl release of the soundtrack.
Oh, wow. That's cool. I see the, what I saw on your website, the next scheduled screening in New York City at Metropolitan Pavilion, like WFMU, which I'm guessing is maybe there, does that tie into their record fair maybe weekend? But it's going to be Saturday, November the 2nd, November the 12th in Steamboat, Colorado. If somebody is interested in getting their local theater house, you know, to show it, how do they lobby to get the film shown in their hometown?
Well, that's the thing. I get people that are hitting me up all the time, like, why don't you show it in this town? I'm like, hey, I'll show it anywhere. But like, if you want your theater to bring boom, you know, into town, you got to hit up your theater. You know, that's just how this works. I can't just bring my movie there. Like they have to book the movie, and, you know, theater owners need to know that the movie is something that people want to see. So yeah, anybody out there, if you're in a small town, I mean, dude, we'll show it anywhere. Like I'm excited to bring it. I'll fly out, do Q&As. Like I'm so honored that people are excited to see this movie that, you know, I'm just excited to talk about it. So it's really been a pretty incredible experience. But yeah, if you want boom in your town, you got to just hit up your theater and just let them know. And that's half the screenings that have been booked have basically been because the theater owners have been, you know, hassled by patrons, and we're selling out a lot of these screenings. So it's been really cool.
So you mentioned Rob Lynn, you know, he's the sax guy, and out of the original members, he's the one guy that is still trying to keep that the engine going, still doing live shows. How do you feel about his version of the Sonics continuing to play?
I love it. I mean, you know, they played the big Seattle premiere we had at Mopop, you know, and obviously it's not the reunion lineup. It's not the same, but, you know, any opportunity people have where they can go out and hear this incredible music live, I just think that you're lucky. And, you know, I don't know how much longer Rob is going to be wanting to do it, but you know, just any chance people get to hear this music played live is it's really special.
So Jordan, I have not been able to see the film, just, you know, just the trailers, but I know Rob has got this great story about Bruce Springsteen. Is that in the film?
It's not in the film, no, but he told it and I've talked to him about it a million times. Yeah, the story is, so Rob is an airline pilot and He flew commercial and private, and there was a flight he was doing, and Bruce Springsteen was in the plane. And when Bruce heard that Rob Lind was the pilot, he was like, "Rob Lind? Do you mean Rob Lind from the Sonics?" And ended up in the cockpit talking to Rob, and Rob was just so overwhelmed because, you know, he didn't really know that anybody knew who the hell the Sonics were, and all of a sudden he's got one of the biggest rock stars in the world, just like excited to be talking to him. It blew his mind. You know, Rob loves telling that story. But yeah, you always hear that kind of stuff, you know. It's but man, how cool. Like, how cool to be a pilot and all of a sudden to find out that Bruce Springsteen is excited about this band you did when you were a teenager. I mean, it was just amazing.
Yeah. Well, what are this is a little engine that keeps on chugging, right? You know, I mean, it's been a long journey getting the film done, but it still seems to keep presenting other opportunities for you. Well, what are some other projects you're working on now?
I've got a couple. I'm actually like more of a writer director, you know, narrative stuff. And I've got a couple horror films that I've been working on for a long time that are close. And then I've got a film called Bastards of Young. That's a drama that a guy named Taylor Hanley wrote and is going to be directing, working on getting that going. And as far as, you know, music talks, like, I love music and I'm definitely interested in working in that space. I don't think I could do it like this again. You know, this was such a long, hard, emotional process, but I'm open, you know, I'm open to kind of hear, you know, what else we could do out there.
Man, Jordan, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today on our Coolest Conversations, man.
Hey, thank you. I mean, it's such an honor to be on the show. And to just talk with you and thank you so much for having me.
All right. Well, good luck with all these upcoming screenings and fingers crossed for many more. And we're going to leave with the track off of the Sonics' third album, Introducing the Sonics. It's the Sonics doing Maintaining My Cool in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
All the birds love me, they know I'm a star. I know where it's at, baby, in this here town. I'm what's happening, I can't be put down. Ain't no fool maintaining my cool.
With some of Maintaining My Cool. That was one of the coolest bands ever, the Sonics, here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. That track is on their third album, 1967's Introducing the Sonics. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to director Jordan Albertson for speaking with me today about his documentary, Boom, a film about the Sonics. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing and Kurt Baker for editing our podcast. Speaking of 60s-related bands, the Earls of Babylon. They were active back then, and recently they reformed and hooked up with wicked cool recording artists Brian Ray and Steve Conti for a new single called My Little Frankenstein. And Steve Conti will join us next time around to tell us all about the project on your Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Well, all I need is white women and song.
White women and song. The
loveliest cheese. Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.